I'm a senior research associate at the Center for Drug and Alcohol Studies at the University of Delaware. However, I've actually never been to Delaware before. It's kind of weird in that sense. I've been with them for almost 2 years now, but I'm actually based in Coral Gables, which is a suburb of Miami. So I'm in South Florida. So it's kind of weird like that. People always come up to me afterwards saying, "Oh, you know, I went to the University of Delaware, but I don't have anything to add there." So, but I did want to let you guys know that we do have a big contingency in the South Florida area as far as our research team. About 30 employees, several research studies going on in the areas of substance abuse and HIV prevention as well. I don't have any financial relationships to disclose, nor any conflicts of interest. And I just wanted to also, before I begin, acknowledge the project coordinator for this study, Dr. Ibanez, and also co-PIs Dr. Kurtz and Dr. Inciardi. First, I want to kind of get into a little bit about what prescription drug abuse is. It's you know, it may seem like a new phenomenon, especially considering all the recent media attention that it's been getting. When we look at the untimely death of Michael Jackson, Heath Ledger, and also celebrities like Eminem have also had problems with prescription drug misuse. It can be defined in different ways, however, generally speaking, it kind of falls into two categories. One, individuals who are taking prescription drugs without a prescription, and two, individuals who are taking them in ways not prescribed by their doctor. This could consist of taking them more than prescribed, or taking them, if you're supposed to take them orally, if you decide to snort them or shoot them, that would also consist of prescription drug misuse. It also is a widespread problem that's actually increasing. According to NISDA, actually 5.2 million Americans have reported misusing prescription drugs in the past month. The most commonly abused prescription drugs are sedatives, opioids, and stimulants, the most common of which are opioids, painkillers, which actually constitute 75% of all prescription drug misuse in this country. It is an emerging public health problem. It actually cost the country $9.5 billion in 2005. When we look at treatment costs, law enforcement costs, healthcare costs, and lack of productivity, things like that. And also, when we look at now that it's causing more death than cocaine and heroin. Prescription drug diversion is actually a term that I think less people are familiar with, and I'm going to be talking a little bit about that, so I kind of wanted to define it first. It really is just talking about the process of prescription drugs going from the legal marketplace to the illegal marketplace, and I'll kind of flesh that out for you in a second. South Florida has been identified as well as a problem area for this. Maybe some of you may have unfortunately heard about the South Florida area as it relates to prescription drug problems on CNN and other national news outlets. So this is kind of a graph that kind of illustrates some of the common methods of diversion. As you can see here on the outside in green, this is kind of the normal trajectory that prescription drugs should take. They're produced both domestically and internationally. There's a legal distribution system that, in warehouses and things like this. Then they arrive at healthcare facilities, and then they're dispensed to patients. However, at any point along this trajectory, they can be diverted. Some common methods of diversion are being smuggled across the border at production plants or production areas, being hijacked, vehicle hijackings or thefts at warehouses along the distribution system. And then once they arrive at healthcare facilities, unscrupulous doctors giving prescription drugs to patients, corrupt employees stealing or undercounting at pharmacies and hospitals, things like this. And then also, once they reach the hands of the patients, it's not uncommon as well for to hear stories of patients selling their prescription drugs as well. This is especially when we look at some news outlets. South Florida has been labeled the Columbia for pharmaceutically diverted drugs, and also the painkiller capital of the United States. So that just kind of illustrates how much of a problem it is in South Florida and also nationwide. The South Florida Health Survey is a study that we have going on where my data comes from. It's a four-year study that's funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And to kind of better get at this problem, we're collecting data from three vantage points: the vantage point of a prescription drug abuser, the prescription drug dealer, and also law enforcement. Basically, what we're doing is, the specific aim to this particular project is that we're going to be interviewing 1,800 participants, prescription drug abusing participants from six different populations. And you can see the different populations here. Individuals who are active member of a methadone clinic, individuals who actively abuse illicit substances such as crack, heroin, methamphetamine. We're also looking at in treatment populations, both publicly funded and privately funded, gay and bisexual males, and also individuals who are over the age of 60. Now, everyone who qualifies for the study is completing a computer-assisted personal interview, where we collect interviews on their sexual behaviors, psychosocial characteristics, where they're getting the drugs from, things of that nature. Also, individuals who have extensive abuse histories and individuals who have multiple methods of diversion, we are selecting them for qualitative interviews as well, 30 from each subsample for a total of 180. We're also going to be talking to prescription drug traffickers. 50 in-depth interviews will be conducted there. And then also, as far as the law enforcement is concerned, we're going to be obtaining information from arrest records and talking to diversion investigators as well. Very briefly, to qualify for the study, we're not talking to children. You have to be 18 or over. You have to have abused prescription drugs at least 5 times in the last 90 days. And depending upon what category they fall in here, we determine it that way. So for example, we're looking at people who have been in treatment for less than 45 days, an active member of a methadone clinic, an active abuser of illicit drugs, over the age of 60 for elderly, and for MSM, males who identify as being gay or bisexual, and also have some stimulant use as well in the last 90 days. How we're collecting the data. We are utilizing a variety of purposive sampling strategies, primarily print media advertisements, online recruiting, handing out of study cards, and posting of flyers is really how we're getting most of our participants. Also, we have some relationships with methadone clinics in the area, as well as drug treatment facilities in the area, and they refer clients to us who fit our eligibility criteria. All participants are asked to call a phone number where we pre-screen them over the phone to determine eligibility and to make sure that they meet all the requirements. Excuse me. Again, everyone who does qualify completes a one-time computer-assisted interview of a quantitative nature, and then we select subsamples of individuals who are actively involved in prescription drug abuse and diversion. And we're also interested in selecting for diversity across these following parameters. We pay our participants $30 for the interview, and we also utilize a chain referral method where we pay $10 for referrals as well, up to 5. So my presentation is going to be presenting on the qualitative data that we've collected thus far. We have collected 56 qualitative interviews from participants, and of those 56, we've had 30 people who have mentioned obtaining prescription drugs from pain clinics. So those 30 interviews are going to be the subject of my research, and we're going to be looking at it from two angles. The drug-seeking behaviors of the abusers who utilize pain clinics as a primary source, and also some of the practices or characteristics of the pain clinics that may be contributing to the problem. This is just a quick breakdown of the sample. Race ethnicity-wise, it's primarily white. Average age is about 35 years. We have a good mix of men and women, gender-wise, and these are the subgroups that are part of the sample. As far as data analysis is concerned, the interviews usually lasted about 90 minutes, 60 to 90 minutes. They were audio taped, transcribed verbatim into Microsoft Word by a professional transcriber, and then imported into InVivo 8, where they were coded for themes, following a grounded theory approach. These are the findings. After analysis, they yielded six main findings, which we'll get into in detail in a bit. Pill mills, on-site pharmacies, liberal prescribing habits, drug diversion, pain doctor shopping, and falsifying symptoms and documentation. So the first main theme that we found was that most of the participants, when they described the type of pain clinic that they got the drugs from, they usually had these types of characteristics, okay? They were very congruent with the characteristics of what we would call pill mills. And these are basically any health kind of healthcare facility that is inappropriately dispensing prescription drugs. And these are some characteristics that were commonly associated with the pain clinics that our participants visited. Accepting cash only. Most of the pain clinics in the South Florida area do not accept insurance, which exempts them from some rigorous inspections, but I'll get into that a little bit later. No physical exam required, no medical records needed, and so on and so forth. Patients telling the doctor what they want prescribed, crowded waiting rooms, unusually crowded waiting rooms, and also the presence of security guards. A quick quote from one of our participants, you go in there and you don't even need to have the MRI. Don't even need to be legit. He's just like, so what do you want? You have pain? I'm like, yeah, it hurts right here and here. And he's like, okay, well, what do you like? So this quote kind of illustrates actually two of the characteristics from that pill mill list. One, no records are needed. A lot of participants go in there. They don't need any MRI. They just kind of go in there and say, I have pain here, here, and here. And I like this. This usually works for me. And the doctor tends to prescribe it. Secondly, on-site pharmacies. Usually you associate obtaining prescription drugs from a pharmacy. However, a lot of pain physicians in the South Florida area are being granted a license to dispense medication on site. And this was a major factor among our participants. They loved to go to pain clinics that had on-site pharmacies. It was very convenient for them. And these are some of the reasons why. They had problems when they go to typical pharmacies or not on-site pharmacies. Some pharmacies may be out of stock of the class 2 medications or not have the medications there. Two, a lot of them went there experiencing withdrawal symptoms, and having to wait or having to drive to a pharmacy was a big deal. They wanted rapid relief of the withdrawal symptoms, and being able to obtain the prescription drugs on site, that was something that was very important to them. They also were able to get the pills in their possession very quickly, where they could immediately start selling the pills to friends, fellow abusers, to turn a profit. And it was also important for doctor shoppers as well, where they didn't have to go to an outside pharmacy. I wanted to kind of illustrate for you, this is a local magazine in the South Florida area where pain clinics tend to advertise very heavily in. And this is very typical. I wanted to kind of show you how common on-site dispensing is for pain clinics. As you can see here, it's something that's well publicized, it's something that they advertise a lot, and it's something that prescription drug abusers tend to use to choose which pain clinic they go to. This is a quote here. They're easy. You walk in and you walk out with the drugs in like 10 minutes. You can snort them right in your car, before you leave, because they have the pharmacy right there. There was recently a news special in the South Florida area where they kind of stood outside a pain clinic, and some of the cameras caught people in the parking lots actually walking out and snorting the pills in their car in the parking lot, things like that. So on-site pharmacies was a major factor there. Liberal prescribing habits. A lot of times our participants were actually surprised at how easy it was and how much prescription drugs they could get from these facilities. These are some of the terms that our participants use to describe pain physicians. This kind of illustrates how they perceive them. And we almost never got stories of, well, I've never prescribed enough. You know, I always find myself running out. And they were consistently able to sell, meet their habit and also have extra pills to sell to generate income for their visit to the next pain clinic. This was a number that kept coming up. We kept asking them, well, how much do you get prescribed? And 190 and 240 kept coming up. It was like a magic number. We're not quite sure why, but it may be an amount that doesn't really trigger red flags. We're not quite sure yet. A lot of physicians were under investigation, according to our participants, and many only got their prescription drugs from pain clinics for this particular reason. They didn't waste time going to general practitioners or any other types of doctors. I don't know anyone who would go to a hospital or a general practitioner. They treat you different. They won't write you a prescription as easily, as quickly, and as much as a pain clinic will. Most doctors are kind of weird about writing, unless you go to a pain clinic. So that kind of illustrates why a lot of prescription drug abusers do go to pain clinics. Drug diversion. And this was actually something that I found very interesting. Like I said before, they were consistently prescribed enough to meet their habit and also sell their extra pills. This was something that every single one of our participants took part in. However, not all participants could afford to keep going to pain clinics and jump around to different pain clinics. So what they did was they took part in a process called sponsoring. This consisted of basically teaming up, essentially. Or if someone couldn't afford to go to the pain clinic, because again, they don't take insurance, you got to pay out of pocket for cash. Basically, two people would team up, and one person would say, "Okay, well, I will pay for the visit, I will pay for the prescription drugs, I will pay for the gas to get there, I will drive you there, but you have to go in, you have to get the pills, and when you come out with the pills, you're going to give me half, and you can keep the remaining half." So this was a way that, and on the streets it's called sponsoring, this was a way that for people who couldn't afford to get the pills on their own, they would team up and get it this way. Some participants reported being sponsored by others, some participants reported being the sponsor to other people as well. This usually consisted of two people going in the endeavor. However, sometimes you'd have what we call team sponsoring, people of abusers, three and four abusers, teaming up, pooling in their money, one person going to the pain clinic, coming out with pills, and then divvying up the pills according to how much money each person contributed. You say, "Look, I'll pay for you to get your MRI, the visit, and the pills every month, but you just have to give me half of them. This way I can still get my pills at a discounted rate, and he has to go through all the work. That way I didn't have to deal with a paper trail, and if they ever get caught, it's on them." Pain doctor shopping. And this refers to, some of you may be familiar with it, but this refers to shopping different doctors. And a lot of times, one doctor doesn't know what the other doctor is doing. So you'll find that one person will go to multiple pain clinics to get multiple prescriptions for prescription drugs. And most pain clinics put a 30-day limit on their patients. So essentially, you can come in, be prescribed prescription drugs, but you can't return until 30 days. So to circumvent this 30-day waiting period, what a lot of people would do is visit more than one. And a lot of people would visit, you know, four or five. It wasn't uncommon for this to happen. In fact, all participants reported doing this at some point in time. You go to one doctor and you get a prescription, but you're going to run out way before the month is up. So you go see another doctor and you have him write you a script. And then maybe you go to maybe another pain clinic and get yourself a third script. So that way you pretty much get them all month long. And then the last major theme that we found was that participants tended to falsify documentation and symptoms. It wasn't uncommon for participants to explain researching the condition before they got to the doctor, so that when the doctor asked them a few questions, that they would know what to say, they would sound legitimate. Also, a lot of participants told us about bringing in props such as canes and walking in with limps. We heard, it wasn't uncommon for people to rehearse what they're going to do before they go in. Essentially it was a big production. Sometimes people even screaming in the waiting rooms in pain, actually crying, bursting out into tears, things like this. The types of symptoms that were commonly falsified were back pain, headaches, knee pain, and difficulty sleeping. When asked why, a lot of people would say, well, that these types of pains were very difficult to substantiate. Back pains, headaches, it's very difficult to say that someone isn't feeling this. Secondly, is falsifying documentation. Again, it wasn't uncommon for the doctor not to ask for any kind of written documentation, but when it was asked for, that usually the document of choice was the MRI. This was almost always asked. There wasn't really any other type of medical record required. However, obtaining an MRI is very expensive. So a lot of times people would come in with fake MRIs, created on a computer, on Photoshop, Googling, blank MRI and then just printing it off of a printer, or buying it from an unauthorized source. And this usually consisted of, you have street MRI dealers who sometimes wait outside pain clinics and peddle MRIs, or employees who work at an MRI place who, I can get an MRI for you, or, who sell MRIs on the side. I would say that I had a problem, that I didn't have to get the pills that I needed, shoulder stuff or any other old injuries that I could think of that I had from football or basketball. I'd research it too and then know what to say. Basically pull out the PDR. So again, this kind of illustrates how people, how serious people take it and the lengths that people go to dupe doctors. Lastly, what does this all mean? Well, this research is an additional dimension to the diversion array that not much is known about. There is previous research that suggests that pain clinics are a source for prescription drugs among prescription drug abusers, but this research kind of gets at the actual how it's being done. The findings also suggest that it's a significant diversion source, as it was very common in our sample and in other research as well. And we believe that these findings directly inform regulatory agencies in industry, law enforcement, and other health policy makers. Up until recently, Florida was one of only 12 states that did not have a prescription drug monitoring program. 38 of the 50 states have a PMP. And many experts believe that it was because of a lack of a PMP why South Florida has, actually the whole state has been a problem area in this regard. A lot of people from neighboring states will visit Florida to get the pills and return to their states. A lot of pain clinics were able to get through a loophole that exempted healthcare facilities that did not accept insurance from being subject to a lot of close monitoring, a lot of health inspections, and a lot of these pill mills were able to get through this particular loophole. In April 2009, Florida did pass a prescription drug monitoring program, and we believe that it's kind of a step in the right direction as far as curbing a lot of this behavior. However, the full effect of the program is not expected to be felt until maybe another year or so. And lastly, we believe that these findings kind of directly inform Florida's prescription drug monitoring program in that regard, as far as how to tailor future initiatives and how to develop best practices in this area. This research was supported by the NIH grant number R01 DA 021330 from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Thank you.
Thank you. We do have some time for some questions, and just want to remind everyone, for those who are interested in this topic, there's going to be another session at 10:30 called Safe Use of Medications as a Public Health Concern in Salon E. It's not in the program because it was put on the program late, but I have a flyer that describes the presenters. So we do have some time for questions. Any questions out there? Yes.
Off the top of my head, the ones that we presented to them. One of them was that prescription drug abuse can kill. Prescription drug abuse, you know, it was, you took that mystery pill at the party last night, well, now you need a new liver. Kind of those fear appeals. Well, we had a long-term example and then a short-term example, and we wanted to examine if the students would be kind of thinking that far ahead, because as research suggests, they aren't really thinking about this is a long-term damage. So we tried to focus definitely on kind of the visual, for example, this will affect your appearance, and then at the same time have messages that this is the long-term consequence and see which one they responded to the most.
Thank you.
Yeah, what was your sampling method and size?
It was very small, so the results are not very generalizable. We had 16 total students, and it was limited to the Atlanta metro area, but we do want to expand and look at larger audience and a much more kind of diverse audience to see if we can find similar effects.
How did you recruit
those? We actually used a marketing workshop, and they have a recruitment system that they use, and it is random, but it is people that sign up to do focus group studies. But it was demographically mixed.
Yes. This question to Mr. Rayl. What goes in a body determines whether a pain clinic can dispense?
I can't remember the governing body right now, but it's a state. It's a state governing body, and basically, it allows doctors to dispense medications on site, and. Usually, you see this in pain clinics, and a lot of health inspections that other facilities would have to go through, they don't have to go through because they don't accept insurance as a cash only business. And unfortunately, what happens as well is you look at a lot of the owners of pain clinics, they are not doctors, they're private investors, and. A lot of news reports are coming out that they actually have there's a significant amount of them that have criminal histories, and facilities that do accept insurance, if you do have any kind of criminal history, you're not allowed to own a clinic or be an employee in a clinic. But because they are able to kind of fly through this loophole, these types of things are happening.
Yes.
Are there any other factors in Florida besides the legal loopholes that you think makes it such a magnet for people to come and set up these types of facilities? Are there population characteristics?
Yeah, I think you have a lot of, Miami's an urban area, it's a very large area, so you have high amounts of poverty, you also have a high amounts of elderly as well who tend to use prescription drugs. But primarily, I forget the question. Oh, what was the question?
Other than the loophole, what other factors allow these things to flourish?
Right, and I think the major factor other than those population characteristics are the fact that for so long there has not been a PMP there. There really is a relatively little oversight as far as keeping track of who's prescribing what to how much and these types of things.
Yes, in the back.
Mr. Ray, when you were exploring these prescription drug monitoring programs that are available in the 38 states, what types of supportive resources did you find available through those programs for linking patients who were abusing prescription opioids with alternative methods of pain management?
I didn't specifically look at other prescription drug monitoring programs in other states. What I do know is that for a very long time, the reason why this law has been trying to be passed in Florida for a very, very long time, but the reason why is because there's kind of been a growing sentiment that it's going to affect patient privacy, and it also affects prescribing practices of doctors, that individuals who need these drugs for legitimate pain management problems, that doctors may, for fear of Big Brother is watching, won't prescribe as they should. And that's a big reason why it hasn't passed in Florida until recently. But as far as other states, I'm not exactly sure.
Yes, I think thank you for your thoughtful presentation and an attempt to understand this, because it's a huge problem. I can attest the fact that I live in Tennessee, in Appalachian Tennessee, and a lot of the drugs on the street in Tennessee are from Florida.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's amazing. Yeah. And so the early data on prescription monitoring programs indicated that they would be pretty helpful. The later data indicate that at the very least you're going to know how many people are on the street. I hope that there is some positive impact.
Along those same lines, I wonder if some of your practices are wrong. The state that you have these drug monitoring databases, they're not quite working the way we thought they were.
Right.
Because doctors have to use them. They have to enter the correct information. And then when you come in, they have to not overlook the fake ID. And I just wonder if anyone knew if the research is showing that they are reducing drug exposure.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I very much learned a lot about it. One of the questions that I wish you'd share more was the law enforcement piece. You mentioned using the arrest records to inform your data. What did that look like? What did you extract from the records? How did it inform what you were doing?
Yeah, that part of our project hasn't gotten we haven't collected that data yet. However, we do have, it's going to be starting very soon. We have partnered with some diversion units in the South Florida area. What we want to know is, where are the drugs coming from? How are they getting to the streets? And what we're going to be doing is looking at what types of pills are commonly being diverted, where are they coming from, and then also we're going to be doing in-depth interviews with diversion investigators. One of the unfortunate things is that in South Florida, Broward County has been identified as a problem county, if you will, for this problem, and unfortunately, due to budget restrictions and budget cutbacks, they have disbanded their diversion unit. So that's kind of one thing that we're kind of curious about. But I can't really speak too much to that, because that data collection hasn't taken place as yet. But we're hoping that it does provide a unique perspective to the whole situation.
I wanted to ask, any intentions to share this information with the pain clinic facilities?
No, not really. however, we hope that they do get wind of everything. But for the most part, they're aware. I mean, they know what's going on. We don't have any explicit intentions on doing that, but. And I don't think that they're unaware of what's going on.
But one quick second question, this is kind of random, but why did you have a specific subgroup for MSM calls?
Well, those six particular populations were chosen because of previous research that indicated prescription drug misuse to be an active phenomenon in those particular subpopulations.
Yes.
Yeah, this question is for the first presenter. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the sampling strategy for the database. Given that it's self-administered, I was puzzled or interested in sort of social desirability issues, that could the database actually be grossly underrepresenting the data? nature of the problem, given if you're asked a question and you're using prescription drugs, the natural response is to sort of non-report that.
Oh, yeah, well, in fact, that is an issue. You know, asking about something directly is going to yield more reports than if you have to volunteer, simply for a whole variety of different reasons. So that's why I wanted to emphasize that these were just respondent reports. We weren't trying to make any inferences to the entire population, but we were just trying to track, based on these data, what seemed to be happening in what respondents are voluntarily reporting.
Yes.
Is it Ms. Agnew?
Yes.
I'm curious, in the research about alcohol prevention approaches with youth, you know, we hear that scare tactics don't actually work. And I'm wondering if you know anything about how, like, in terms of the things resonating with the youth, might something resonate but not actually be effective in the long term? And do you know data about that with scare tactics?
Definitely, I see what you're saying about the message resonance may not actually have an impact on intentions and actual behavioral use. Really, the reason we were looking at resonance right now is that it's the first step towards examining effective messaging. And because prescription drugs are so new, there hasn't really been that kind of extensive research on if scare tactics would be effective long term. But one of the reasons we want to explore that avenue is because, unlike alcohol, there hasn't been that negative messaging that students have really been exposed to. And there really are exclusively those positive ads about prescription drugs, the normalizing of use. So maybe this is a perfect storm almost, that right now you could use it, potentially down the road you couldn't. And when students kind of figure out that maybe those, the reason that scare tactics may not be effective, I think, with alcohol is that they don't see those severe negative consequences when they do use alcohol. And so with prescription drugs, maybe scare tactics could be used for now. And it really needs to be investigated, like you're saying, because we don't know what messages would be effective at this point. But because prescription drugs are different, you kind of need to go down that same road that they've done with the research with alcohol and other illicit drugs.
Thank you.
In the back, yes.
Thank you. This is another stop. It may be an artifact of sampling or sampling methods, but I'm curious if such a large number of such are in treatment, they are in substance use treatment. And would you like to comment on what that says about treatment issues?
I'm sorry, I had a little bit of difficulty hearing you. We did find that among our sample of treatment clients that I would say a relatively significant amount of them did obtain prescription drugs through the pain clinic. As it relates to drug treatment, I'm not really sure of the connection there, but I'm not really sure where to go with that. Sorry.
Several of the slides had quotes from subjects in methadone maintenance programs.
Yeah.
And there was a certain dosing issue that might come up with regard to prescription drug that was misused on the side. So I was wondering, in terms of testing someone in the substance abuse treatment program, what you might say about that.
I'm sorry. I don't know.
Okay, well, I think we're just about out of time. Thank you very much for all your questions. And